For those of you who might not know me, my name's Casey. I am a member of the staff here, although my day job, as it were, actually literally my day job, is that I work down the hill at the university where I teach history. But I'm so privileged to get to be a part of the staff here and part of the community of STC Sheffield. And I also have the privilege, Tom asked me to speak tonight at the first of these evening gatherings as we sort of get started back up and we start a new series of looking at the question of hospitality and engagement with other people. And so I've been reflecting this week on hospitality, and in particular the story we're going to look at tonight, which is when someone, specifically Jesus, invites themselves into someone else's home without a previous invitation. It's the sort of bold thing that polite British people don't do, but crass Americans do all the time. Maybe there is a reason Tom asked me to talk to... Never mind. It actually reminded me of a story from a friend of ours when we lived down in Oxford. It was a guy that ran the company that my wife worked for a while, and they just bought a house out in a lovely little village in the Cotswolds and moved into this, what was originally a 15th century pub that had been expanded a couple of times and turned into a house, and you could see the old big fire spit in the lounge. Oh, it was a gorgeous place. And so they'd moved in, and they'd been in, I don't know, 4 or 5 months, something like that, when May Day came around. Some of you may know this, as an American, I didn't when I moved here, but around May Day is when all the Morris dancers come out, right? Maybe you want to ignore that that's a thing, but it is sort of a thing. So they're just there on a Saturday afternoon doing whatever, when all of a sudden on the front door they hear, my mate looks at his wife and goes, "You expecting somebody?" She goes, "No." "You expecting somebody?" "No." So he walks to the front door, which nobody ever comes to the front door, and opens it up, and there's like 20 Morris dancers outside. And he goes, "Hi, can I help you?" And the guy literally goes, "Mate, where's the beer?" Because this was the old pub. And every year the Morris dancers went round the village dancing and came to the old pub, and the people that owned it before them and the people that owned it before them just knew that they needed to have beer for the Morris dancers. Apparently that message didn't get passed down, and so there's my mate standing at the door going, I'm sorry. They go, "This is the old White Hart pub, isn't it?" He goes, "Yes." They go, "Where's the beer?" He said, "I don't know, but it'll be better next year." So rather than get cross, rather than be inhospitable, my mate worked out for the next year to go to the local brewery and get them to donate a keg to him, invited me to come around and pull pints, because, you know, what do you need other than an American to pull pints at a Morris dancing party? The Morris dancers came around, he said, "Beer's around the side, it's a pound a pint, and all the money goes to the local hospice." And they loved it. And we raised, I don't know, a lot. I mean, you can imagine Morris dancers and pints and up a pound a go. We raised a lot of money for the hospice that day, and my accent got made fun of a lot, and I got convinced that Morris dancers were kind of freaky. If there are any Morris dancers in the audience, apologies, but it is a bit odd, right? Can we all agree on that? It is a bit odd, right? In any event, there was an opportunity when my mate could have said, "No thanks, you've invited yourself into my home. I don't really want you or need you here." But he took a step back and he thought, actually, maybe there's a way for me to be hospitable in this situation, and maybe there's a way for me to make something good out of that. And that is sort of part of the story that we're going to see tonight when we look at this text in the Gospel of Luke that Tom has asked me to speak on and asked me to use as a way of opening us up to thinking about what God has to say about hospitality. And specifically, what God has to say about not just showing hospitality to people who look and act like us, but to people who are very different from us and to whom being hospitable might be a bit frightening, a bit challenging, even potentially a bit embarrassing, but is still what God calls us to do as an act of building the kingdom of God by resisting so much of what is broken in society. And so that's what we're going to look at tonight. The passage, if you want to follow along, is in the Gospel of Luke, chapter 19, verses 1 to 9. I think we might have, do we have a PowerPoint slide with those? Hey, look at that. Kind of like the weatherman when he asks for the map and it all of a sudden appears behind him, but not going to tell you anything about storms or anything tonight. So this is a story which you might be familiar with. If you're like my wife, she can never hear the name Zacchaeus without singing the Little Zacchaeus song. I don't know if you all learned the Wee Little Zacchaeus song. I didn't learn the Wee Little Zacchaeus song. And if we've established, I shouldn't be singing anyway. So I'm just going to read the Bible now. Luke chapter 19. Jesus entered Jericho and was passing through. A man was there by the name of Zacchaeus. He was a chief tax collector and was wealthy. He wanted to see who Jesus was, but being a short man, he could not because of the crowd. So he ran ahead and climbed a sycamore fig tree to see him, since Jesus was coming that way. When Jesus reached the spot, he looked up and said to him, "Zacchaeus, come down immediately. I must stay at your house today." So he came down at once and welcomed him gladly. All the people saw this and began to mutter, "He's gone to be the guest of a sinner." But Zacchaeus stood up and said to the Lord, "Look, Lord, here and now I give half of my possessions to the poor. And if I have cheated anybody out of anything, I will pay back four times the amount." And Jesus said to him, "Today salvation has come to this house, because this man too is a son of Abraham." And if you were to put verse 10 on, it would tell you, "For the Son of Man came to seek and save what was lost." This is the word of the Lord. Thanks be to God. Now, what I want to do is I just want to walk us through this passage. And I want us to think about what Jesus is doing, who Zacchaeus is, and what happens when Jesus invites Zacchaeus to show him hospitality, or perhaps if we read it the other way around, Jesus shows hospitality to Zacchaeus by wanting to be associated with him. And then I just want us to think about how that is a model for what God calls each and every one of us to do. So we're going to walk through it. I want to point out a few things about the story that I think help us to see what's going on. And then I want to try and reflect on that for our lives. So the story starts by telling us something that we can run very quickly past and ignore, but which I think is really helpful, which Luke really wants us to notice in order to understand this story. Chapter 19, verse 1 says, "Jesus entered Jericho." And this is only one of two times in the entire Gospel of Luke that Jericho is mentioned. So that must mean something. Well, if you look back in the Gospel of Luke for Jericho, you find yourself in chapter 10. And in chapter 10, you find a story of a man who was walking from Jerusalem down to Jericho and saw someone in the ditch on the other side of the road who had been beaten and robbed. It's the parable of the Good Samaritan, perhaps the most famous passage in all of the Bible, maybe certainly the most famous passage perhaps in the New Testament, so I won't recount it for you, because you all know that the story of the Good Samaritan is about what it means to love one's neighbor and to understand whose one neighbor is. And in that case, for a foreigner, a Samaritan, a hated outsider, to do this better than a Jewish person from Jerusalem, which is whom the audience would have thought knew what was right. So the first thing that we should have in mind when we hear that Jesus is in Jericho is the parable of the Good Samaritan, because he hasn't been back to Jericho since. He hasn't mentioned Jericho since. Jericho has been nowhere in our minds. The second thing that any audience with any Jewish background whatsoever would think of when they hear Jericho is the story in the book of Joshua of the Israelites crossing the Jordan and coming to Jericho and marching round, and the walls came tumbling down, and that was the beginning of the conquest of the land that God promised. It was the first stage in a series of steps by which God turned something into the kingdom that God designed it to be. And that's important because Jericho plays the same function in this portion of Luke's gospel. This comes at the end of a whole series of stories in Luke's gospel, which are called the travel narrative. Jesus has been going all over the place, but he comes to Jericho. He heals a blind man outside. He has this encounter with Zacchaeus inside Jericho that we're going to look at. And then he leaves and he goes up to Jerusalem for the triumphal entry and for Holy Week and for the crucifixion and the resurrection. That is no accident. Luke is telling us this story in this place as part of that trajectory on purpose, because he wants us to think about what Jesus is doing as he is traveling through Jericho on his way to Jerusalem. Spoiler alert, this is the first step in Jesus' battle to conquer and build a kingdom in an utterly different way than Joshua and the Israelites did. But it is still the first step in that plan. So Jericho matters. Jericho gives us context for what Jesus is doing. And the second thing that we need to notice in order to understand what's happening here is what happens in the second verse, which is it tells us about a man called Zacchaeus. Now everybody thinks, well, okay, the important thing to know about Zacchaeus, he's a wee little man. He's got to go climb a tree so he can see Jesus. You know, funny stuff, stories, images, you know, Zacchaeus on a felt board moving around and all that sort of stuff, right? Actually, the most important thing about Zacchaeus isn't that he's short. The most important thing about Zacchaeus is that he's called Zacchaeus. There's a preacher's name for it, right? Zacchaeus, right? Okay, well, what's important about Zacchaeus? Well, Zacchaeus' name means pure one, when actually his role in the story is to be anything but the pure one. He is the one that when Jesus associates with him, everybody else goes, sinner. You have to like hiss it out. You have to be as snake-like. You have to be, get your inner Snape going, right? Get the sinner, right? That's who Zacchaeus is. The one called Pure One is the worst of the lot. But actually, there's another thing about Zacchaeus that's important, because Zacchaeus is a Greek name. Now, we don't know, because at the end of the passage, Jesus will call Zacchaeus a son of Abraham after he's saved. He might have been Jewish and had a Greek name, or he might have actually been a Gentile. He might not have been Jewish at all and been a Roman tax collector who was in Judea and was therefore even more disliked, because not only was he collecting their taxes, and nobody likes tax collectors, but he was a foreigner collecting their taxes. Best case scenario for Zacchaeus is he's from a Jewish family, took a Greek name to sound less Jewish, and became a tax collector. Still not great. Still not a good look if you're trying to be liked by the people around you. Zacchaeus is at some level an outsider, maybe even a full-on foreigner. And so the first two things that Luke does, bang, bang, in verses 1 and 2, is tells us we're in Jericho, and Jericho is important because it's the first step in a battle to build, to take control of a place for God. And to remind us of the parable of the Good Samaritan, where it's the foreigner who shows us what it is to love a neighbor in a self-sacrificial way, and to associate Jesus with this person who is either a full-on foreigner or very actively identifying himself with the foreigners to do this job. And it's within that context that we then have to think about the hospitality of this interaction between Jesus and Zacchaeus. So, when it gets to verse 5, and Jesus says to Zacchaeus, come down immediately, I must stay at your house today, all sorts of light bulbs should be going off for us. Jesus is inviting himself into the home of not just a sinner, but a foreigner. He's risking his reputation. He's suggesting that he's willing to spend time with people who are not only not like him, but are the most despised in the community. Even if he has status, he's a tax collector, even if he has wealth, and it says he is wealthy, and we can imagine he's probably wealthier than we even imagine, Jesus not only is willing to associate with him, he's willing to go to his home. Now, at one level, it sounds crassly American. I'm here, you probably got some nice furniture and a decent fridge full of food. I'll have your house. Thanks, mate. But it is more about Jesus being willing to take the first step, to radically step across lines of difference and indeed hatred, and show that he's willing to associate with Zacchaeus. And Zacchaeus is willing to receive him in return. He doesn't say, how about we just have a conversation here? Because you seem a bit interesting, but I'm not really quite sure I want to be seen with you in my house. Zacchaeus doesn't resist that at all. And the first transformation happens when Zacchaeus says, after he hears all the people shouting that he's a sinner, in verse 8, look, Lord, you want to come and associate with me? That's amazing. Let me tell you what I'm going to do first, because you have stepped in my direction. Zacchaeus stood up and said to the Lord, but we can assume, because he's been in a tree with a big crowd around, that Jesus is not the only person who hears what Zacchaeus says. Look, Lord, here and now I give half of my possessions to the poor. He does five times what the Jewish Torah would ask him, which is to give a tithe of 10%. He says, I'll give half of all my stuff. And he then goes on to say, if I've cheated anybody, if I've defrauded anyone, it says in a lot of other translations, out of anything, I will pay back four times the amount, which means he willingly takes on twice the penalty he should pay for a crime. To defraud someone is to steal someone, something from someone. In the Jewish Torah, if I steal 5 pounds from you, I give you the 5 pounds back. I give you five of my own pounds. So I have to experience the same loss that I inflicted upon you. Zacchaeus says, I will pay back four times. He doubles the amount that he will pay to show that he is going above and beyond to bring justice. Zacchaeus declares the truth. I have not done with my money what I should do. I have treated others poorly, and I will admit that, and I will give the reparations necessary for that. Because Jesus' radical commitment to doing the right thing, when it crosses this line of difference and invites Zacchaeus in, is radically transformative. Zacchaeus knows what he should do. Jesus doesn't have to tell him. Zacchaeus has a guilty conscience already because he's sure that he isn't living right. Jesus doesn't have to condemn him. The mere act of Jesus being willing to associate with him without condemning him, without calling him out, without, as I think you all might say, because this stuff is beyond me, canceling Zacchaeus, Jesus brings about the radical transformation that he wants. Now, it doesn't happen all in a moment. Jesus' impact on Zacchaeus is about a whole lifetime, a whole trajectory that has taken him to this place. Zacchaeus is interested to know who Jesus is because Jesus has been making a stir in the whole of Judea because of the way he lives and the way he speaks, the way he self-sacrificially loves others, the way he teaches with authority in a way others don't, the way he lives a life of moral rectitude, of saying and doing things that seem radical and crazy, but both deeply true and hugely welcoming to even the worst sinners amongst the community. Ended not condemning, not canceling, not ignoring Zacchaeus, he calls forth a transformation that is already at work in Zacchaeus' heart. What Jesus does in hospitality is a form of nonviolent resistance against all that is broken in society. It is not simple, and it is not passive, just like nonviolent resistance is never that. And in a week where here in the UK, we came up on the anniversary of Stephen Lawrence's death, and in a week where in my country of birth, the United States of America, we finally, at least for a moment, got it right and convicted Derek Chauvin for the murder of George Floyd, it seems only fitting to put what Jesus is doing in the context of race relations and what it might mean to be hospitable, to reach out across the lines of differences that are about race and ethnicity and color. For all sorts of reasons. So the first reflection about how this relates to our life, I want to take from a speech by Martin Luther King Jr., and I'm going to read another quote from him later, because I don't think there's ever a bad time to go look at Martin Luther King Jr. as an example of what it is to be Christ-like in this world. But when it comes to hospitality, and the way in which hospitality is a nonviolent, loving, self-sacrificial act of resistance against all that is broken in this world and seeking to tear down and to prevent God's kingdom from growing, this seems important. These are two things that Martin Luther King says about nonviolence. Now you have to remember, these are things that he wrote when everyone who looked at the movement of nonviolent resistance in the civil rights movement in America said, you need to do more. It's not working quick enough. It's not happening. He says, the alternative to violence is nonviolent resistance. The method was made famous in our generation by Mohandas K. Gandhi, who used it to free India from the domination of the British Empire. 5 points can be made. I won't read you all five. I just want to read you the first two. First, this is not a method for cowards. And by the way, what Jesus does in the Zacchaeus story is not cowardly, and it is not simple. The nonviolent resistor is just as strongly opposed to the evil against which he protests as is the person who uses violence. His method is passive or non-aggressive in the sense that he is not physically aggressive toward his opponent. Please forgive Dr. King for his masculinity and all his pronouns, but please think of it as being human. He is not physically aggressive toward his opponent, but his mind and emotions are always active, constantly seeking to persuade the opponent that he is mistaken. And if you think that Jesus' self-invitation to Zacchaeus' house was not an act of challenge to everyone who hissed, sinner, then you're not reading the story right. A second point is that nonviolent resistance does not seek to defeat or humiliate the opponent, but to win his or her friendship and understanding. The nonviolent resistor must often express his protest through non-cooperation or boycotts, but he realizes that non-cooperation and boycotts are not ends in themselves. They are merely means to awaken a sense of moral shame in the opponent. The end, the goal, the point is redemption and reconciliation. The aftermath of nonviolence is the creation of the beloved community, while the aftermath of violence is tragic bitterness. So, given that probably, hopefully, none of you were planning on going out of here and creating violent resistance against those things in our society which are broken. And let's take this particularly in the context of race relations and class relations and those sorts of things. You might, however, be thinking about later or even now, picking up your phone and saying something extraordinarily derogatory about someone else on social media. Or getting a bunch of people together and going, we don't ever want that person to come and talk here, or to do this, or to do that. Fine. Like, I'm not saying that maybe there aren't occasions on which challenging, calling out, not inviting, deplatforming, whatever language we want to use, might make sense. But generally speaking, the point is not to cancel, to be derogatory, to condemn, and to ostracize. But it is to even be willing to put yourself at risk, to bring the weight of a life, not the weight of a tweet, not the weight of a Facebook post, the weight of a whole life lived in commitment to the morals that you see taught, and in this context, the morals that we see modeled by Christ, to bear by saying, I will even risk listening to something I dislike. I will risk being in the presence of people who other people will go, why on earth would you even talk to them? If I have any hope, and within the Christian faith, we always have hope, that engagement with self-sacrificial love for another, the transformation that only God can bring, can happen. I'm not saying we don't challenge. I'm not saying we don't resist. I'm saying that nonviolent resistance might look passive, that showing hospitality to the people that are very different from us, whether they are the friendly people across the street who are just from another country or another class or another race, or whether it is associating with someone who teaches something that we think is hateful, misogynistic, racist, whatever, in the hopes that we might, through our own self-sacrificial love, persuade them differently, is not passive. It is resistance. And it is the very resistance by which Jesus builds the kingdom of God. Because Zacchaeus' transformation happens in Jericho. And we're reminded that it's in Jericho because Jericho is where the parable of the Good Samaritan happens. And Jesus and Zacchaeus, in their actions, bring the parable of the Good Samaritan to life. They move across boundaries. They move across race. They move across ethnicity in a way that shows that the sort of care and transformation, that Jesus' willingness to move towards Zacchaeus is met by Zacchaeus' willingness to be transformed and move towards Jesus, and lives change. And I'm going to imagine that as wealthy as Zacchaeus is, in that kind of giving, lots of other lives that are poor and need food and need healthcare and need all sorts of stuff change for the better. The kingdom of God comes that day in Jericho because Jesus is willing to show hospitality to someone different from him. And it comes that day because Zacchaeus is moved by the weight of a life to respond in kind. And a kingdom starts to get built. And then Jesus goes to Jerusalem. And he dies on a cross, condemned, and rises up and goes to heaven and leaves a church, us. And he says, be my hands and feet in this world. Be the ones that continue to cross those enduring lines of difference, even those lines of hatred. Don't just cancel. Don't condemn. Don't disparage. Don't call out with disgust. Take the weight of your life, lived as God calls for it to be lived, and apply it through a willingness to engage, through an openness, through a hospitality to those different from you, in the hope and the trust that what began in Jericho 2,000 years ago and continued in Jerusalem weeks later, and then amongst a small community of people that were so afraid that they hid in an upper room in Jerusalem, had to be frightened out of Jerusalem by other things to go into the world, but eventually did it, became a message that literally transformed history. That's what we're asked to do. I'm going to invite the band to come back up now. And as I get ready to close, I'm going to read you another quote from Martin Luther King Jr. And it's a longer one, but it's way better than anything I would come up with to close the sermon. So, you know, when in doubt, outsource. This is a speech that Martin Luther King gives on the steps of the state capitol in Montgomery, Alabama, at the end of the march from Selma, one of the most difficult and enduringly important moments in the civil rights movement. And it just captures for me so perfectly what I hope our attitude is in seeing the simple interaction between Jesus and Zacchaeus, the foreigner, the pure one, the sinner who is transformed in this moment, to what we are called to do, to follow in those footsteps. Forgive me if I get a bit excited as I read, but I can't really read this without being moved, and I hope that you can't hear it without being moved either. My people, listen. The battle is in our hands. The battle is in our hands in Mississippi and Alabama and all over the United States. So as we go away this afternoon, let us go away more than ever before committed to the struggle and committed to nonviolence. I must admit to you, there are still some difficulties ahead. And I'm not saying any of this would be easy. There are difficulties ahead for all of us in working out how to do this and in trusting that God might work through it. We are still in for a season of suffering in many of the Black Belt counties of Alabama, many areas of Mississippi, many areas of Louisiana. We might now call out Minnesota, and we might call out Ohio. We might call out every other state in America, and we might call out every county and city in this United Kingdom as well, where we know racism still exists. I must admit to you, there are still jail cells waiting for us, dark and difficult moments. We will go on with the faith that nonviolence and its power transform dark yesterdays into bright tomorrows. We will be able to change all of these conditions. Our aim must never be to defeat or humiliate the white man, but to win his friendship and understanding. Think about those words from a man who experienced everything that Martin Luther King Jr. did. Death threats, bombs blown up at his house, churches blown up, people shot, people lynched, unjustly put in jail. Our aim must never be to defeat or humiliate the other, but to win his friendship and understanding. We must come to see that the end we seek is a society at peace with itself, a society that can live with its conscience, that will be a day not of the white man, not of the black man. That will be a day of human as human. I know you're asking today, how long will it take? I come to say to you this afternoon, however difficult the moment, however frustrating the hour, it will not be long, because truth pressed to the earth will rise again. How long? Not long, because no lie can live forever. How long? Not long, because you still reap what you sow. How long? Not long, because the moral arc of the universe is long, but it bends towards justice. How long? Not long, because mine eyes have seen the glory of the coming of the Lord, trampling out the vintage where the grapes of wrath are stored. He has loosed the fateful lightning of his terrible swift sword. His truth is marching on. But not as an army, not in violence, but through nonviolent, self-sacrificial love, through a hospitality shown to people so different from us, other people can't even imagine how we would commune together. The Lord has sounded forth the trumpets that shall never call retreat. He is lifting up the hearts of man before his judgment seat. Oh, be swift, my soul, to answer him. Be jubilant, my feet. Our God is marching on. The call to us is to see what Jesus does in a simple interaction with a wee man with a foreign name and understand it as radical hospitality across all imaginable lines of enduring difference. To understand that that is an act of resistance in a world of hatred and racism and misogyny and all sorts of other things. And to live a life the moral weight of which will show to people as we step across those lines of differences that we have a hope and a trust that things are not as they should be and will be different in the future if we pursue such radical love and self-sacrifice.